Welcome to today's Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa American, read by volunteers at the Recording Library of West Texas. This production is also available at recordinglibrary.org and on the telephone reader by calling 432-617-5555.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Big Bend Sentinel for December 19th, 2019, front page. As the Leach trial continues, District Attorney and Airbnb take note. By Stephen Paulson. STEPHEN at BigBendSentinel.com. Alpine. It's been a little over 3 months since Jeff Leach, a prominent Terlingua man and founder of Basecamp Terlingua, filed a defamation lawsuit against an alleged assault victim. Katie Milam, a former employee at Basecamp, told police in July that Leach had allegedly pinned her down and told her he gets what he wants. In a lawsuit filed in September, Leach accused her of extreme and outrageous conduct and making false defamatory statements. Then, in November, two more women gave affidavits accusing Leach of sexual assault and rape, as the Big Bend Sentinel first reported. One woman alleged Leach raped her. Another alleged Leach sexually assaulted her. The Big Bend Sentinel also reported on a fourth woman who received a temporary restraining order in 2017 after Leach allegedly threatened her. That woman has not responded to requests for comment. The defamation lawsuit was set to have a hearing last week, but that did not happen. Instead, Judge Roy Ferguson reportedly recused himself. At press time, Brewster County courts do not yet have any records on Ferguson's recusal, and Ferguson's office did not respond to a request for comment. Ferguson is the judge who granted the fourth woman a restraining order in 2017 after Leach allegedly threatened her. As the case unfolds, authorities and at least one company are watching. Since reporting our initial story, the Big Bend Sentinel has filed multiple records requests with the Brewster County Sheriff's Office and District Attorney's Office seeking information about Leach. In an email to the Big Bend Sentinel, Brewster County District Attorney Sandy Wilson says she could not provide records on Leach because she's using them in the detection, investigation, or prosecution of a crime. Last month, an Airbnb spokesman also confirmed to the Big Bend Sentinel that it had kicked Leach off its website as a result of the sexual assault allegations. Leach was previously a super host on the vacation rentals site. Court filings from this month offer more context on that termination. In an email dated November 22nd and attached as a court exhibit, an Airbnb employee tells Leach the company has decided to remove him after a routine review. He cites the Big Bend Sentinel's previous reporting on multiple sexual assault allegations against Leach, which he says violate Airbnb community standards. Meanwhile, Leach's defamation case against Milam, who also goes by Schwartz in court filings, has continued. Leach's lawyer, Ray Lifesty, earlier this month filed court documents disputing the allegations made by Milam and the other women. In it is an affidavit from Jeff Leach. I did not force myself on or assault Katie Schwartz in any way, he states. Instead, he states that any contact between us was totally mutually consensual and that it never progressed beyond making out. He states he had multiple pleasant communications with Milam after the alleged assault when he was apparently still her boss. He states he had consensual sex with the woman who filed an affidavit alleging he raped her, including on the date of the alleged rape. That woman has asked the Big Bend Sentinel not to publicly identify her in our reporting. The filing includes a photo of one alleged victim with leech after the alleged assault occurred, which is presented as evidence that the assault did not happen. It also includes multiple affidavits from women, including Leach's girlfriend, disputing the alleged victim's versions of events. Malum's lawyers, Jody Cole and Liz Rogers, have continued to argue in court filings that Malum has a legal right to speak publicly about her alleged assault. They have also filed more of their own affidavits, including from a base camp employee who states she saw Leach doing mushrooms and marijuana at work, and from a man who states Leach allegedly attacked and injured him at a construction job in 2018. In another filing from last week, Cole and Rogers also showed Leach had been arrested for allegedly assaulting the fourth woman, who later obtained a restraining order against him. In an incident report from September 2015, a deputy with the Brewster County Sheriff's Office responded to a property in Terlingua after that woman called 911 to report she'd had an altercation with her boyfriend and was worried he would come back. The woman told the deputy that Leach allegedly went off on her for no apparent reason, began throwing things around the house, grabbed her and shoved her around, and then left, according to the report. The woman called her brother, who attempted to block the door to keep Leach from entering the residence after Leach returned. Leach allegedly grabbed him by the wrist and shoved him against the door, the report states. The deputy said the woman was visibly shaken. In his report, he said he'd tried to question the woman, but that she was extremely evasive and made it clear from her answers that she didn't want to get Leach in trouble and was trying to protect him. Her brother made a voluntary statement to authorities corroborating her version of events. When the deputy questioned Leach at his home, Leach said the woman had jumped on him and attacked him, allegedly hitting him on his neck and head around 20 times, he said. But the deputy found no signs of a struggle on Leach. He determined Leach to be the aggressor and arrested him for assault family violence. In follow-up court filings from that woman, which are also included in Colin Rogers' filings, she also alleges Leach assaulted her at least twice more, once in Terlingua in March 2016, when he allegedly threw her on a bed and rubbed blood in her face, and once in Paris in September 2016. Another court hearing is scheduled for January 10th. Marfa's Blackwell School joins the National Register of Historic Places. By Abby Perot, ABBIE at BigBendSentinel.com. Marfa. Marfa's historic Blackwell School, a reminder of school segregation, received an honorific designation to the National Register of Historic Places for its significant contribution to the broad patterns of our history, according to the application approved by the National Parks Service on December 4th. The Blackwell School, built at the turn of the 20th century by Presidio County and the local school district, provided primary school education to Marfa's Hispanic children at 501 South Abbott Street in what is now South Central Marfa. Despite mandated segregation for African-American students, there was never any national or state mandate to separate Hispanic students from their Anglo counterparts. Instead, the proliferation of segregation between those communities was de facto, mostly put into place by local school districts, and was not legally undone when the Supreme Court desegregated Anglo and African-American students. Blackwell educated Marfa's Hispanic elementary and junior high students until 1965, when a new elementary school was constructed and Marfa's education system was integrated. Bonnie Wilson, a historian at the Texas Historical Commission who worked on the Blackwell application, says, "We did not look at this nomination as precedent-setting, and we recognized that this property is unique because it tells the story of Texas Hispanic children's education, which is not a topic that is often covered." Blackwell covers multiple underrepresented subjects: ethnicity, nationality, primary school education, and Marfa's location, Wilson says. It covers an uncommon combination of subjects compared to other designated historic places. Lionel Salgado attended Blackwell from 1941 to 1951, a time he recalls for its good education, good teachers, and good memories. But today, Salgado reflects on the school's legacy in Marfa and is troubled. "A lot of it has been ignored and forgotten, and more ignored than forgotten," Salgado says. "People, for some reason, don't want to think about it, but it's part of history." "One thing I talk about is how burying our past hasn't worked," says Gretel Ink, president of the Blackwell School Alliance. Ink brought her background of nearly 20 years' experience working with the National Park Service to her role at the Alliance. Ink previously worked at the Manzanar National Historic Site, the location of America's Japanese internment camps during World War II. "I saw the power of that place being preserved and people being encouraged to tell their stories and really reclaim their voice around the violation of the Constitution that happened with internment," Ink said. The Blackwell School is a very different story, but at the same time, it's coming from the same place, devaluing people who are different from the people in power. Ink says, "I just believe very, very strongly in the power of storytelling and people being able to claim their stories." When she speaks about the past being buried, there's one literal instance that many Blackwell students recall. The application for the National Register includes a narrative about a 1954 incident at Blackwell where students buried Mr. Spanish. A seventh grade class was instructed to write, "I will not speak Spanish," on paper scraps, place them in a coffin, and during a school-wide gathering around the flagpole, bury the box in a ceremony. The teacher later explained her intention was to help students learn English and lose their accent. After the burial, students were paddled for their language transgressions. As Maggie Marquez recounted to the Big Bend Sentinel in 2007, the school's principal paddled the young student after she told her classmates, "Nadia, me va quitar mi español. No pueden hacernos esto. No one's going to take away my Spanish. They can't do that to us." Even some of our grandkids didn't even know about it. Some of the students' grandkids, Salgado says about Blackwell and its history, "I've mentioned it to my grandkids. I'm proud of it. It happened, and it's part of history. By not mentioning it, it's not going to go away. It happened." Recently, Blackwell has initiated an effort to bring today's Marfa students into the space to educate them on Marfa's past. Compiled over 3 years, the application to the National Register included narratives from former students and teachers, which it relied on heavily since, according to Ink, the school district burned the Blackwell records in the 1950s. Along with oral histories, the application detailed a historic structure report of the two remaining Blackwell school buildings. The other structures were destroyed to make way for low-income housing after the school's closure. It even answered one long-standing mystery: when the Blackwell school was actually built. Late local historian Lon Taylor had volunteered time doing deed research for the Blackwell School Alliance, uncovering documents that disputed a long-running oral history that Blackwell was built in the 1880s. The deed revealed the founder of Marfa, John M. Dean, sold the Blackwell land to the county in 1909, and construction began immediately after. The physical building is crucial to its placement on the register. Wilson says it is representative of that face of Marfa that we might not see. It's the face of the Marfa community and is still, symbolically, an important place for that community. Though segregated Hispanic schools were prolific across the Texas-Mexico border, few remain standing, much less in their near-original condition. Blackwell's addition to the National Register of Historic Places opens the school up for tax credits to complete renovations and improvements. It also broadens grant opportunities, which the Alliance could use to implement more exhibits in the space and toward their goal of hiring an executive director this year. The Permian Basin Area Foundation and its Tillipah Public History Fund have already contributed $25,000 toward the position's salary. Wilson, the historian from the Texas Historical Commission, says Blackwell is likely the only segregated Hispanic school on the register in Texas. In Alpine, the segregated Centennial School is an office building. In Marathon, the Hispanic schoolhouse is eroding into the ground. Fort Davis building is gone. Blackwell's endurance is key to preserving the history of Texas segregated Hispanic border schools. In 2006, a group of alumni formed the Blackwell School Alliance and fundraised to repair the building's exterior. Today, visitors can explore the schoolhouse during open hours and learn more of its history. What we're understanding now is that we preserve an incredibly authentic physical space that is the portal to connecting to a much bigger story, Inc. says. The ongoing American conversation around identity and othering and all of those other things that we really have both the obligation and the opportunity to speak to. Part of it is that nobody else is doing it. Blackwell presents the real history of Marfa, the Hispanic history of Marfa, which might not be as well known as the contemporary art history that's going on in Marfa right now, Wilson explains. This nomination illuminates this history about a popular, well-known city that a lot of people don't know unless you grew up there and lived there. When Wilson mentions location as a unique factor in the Blackwell application, she's speaking about the booming tourism and art scene that a tiny remote town in West Texas somehow came to possess. Wilson says the outsider's perspective of Marfa today differs from what Blackwell is presenting. The designation itself tells the rest of the nation this place is important, the historian says. It has critical importance and meaning to people who grew up and lived there, who made friends, whose family lived there. It's more than just a school. It's an integral part of the Hispanic community's culture and their past. It's not just a segregated story. It's about that community, their family and friends, and all the opportunities the school gave them. Salgado credits the Blackwell Block Party as one of the greatest things that happened at the school because it brought all of the people of Marfa together and it gave us a chance to show the people of Marfa that we are in this together, Salgado says of the yearly event. That's the idea of being one community together. Together we can do a lot of things. The Block Party is going to grow in 2020. Along with the April 25th celebration, a series of meetings on April 23rd and 24th will gather community stakeholders to address conflicts and seek resolution through a series of gatherings. These will be facilitated public meetings where the Alliance plans to listen, brainstorm, and receive input. Now we're on the National Register, what do we do with that, and what do people want to see happen here? Inc. says. How do we make sure all of the voices are heard, the divergent, challenging voices? Inc. asks. Let's hold space for that, too, because if this is going to work, It's going to require all the support of all of Marfa, and I think there's hope for that. Burying our past has not healed our community, Inc. says. If there is a way that the Blackwell School can be a place to really hold space for all the emotions and conversations, that would be a dream come true, if that could somehow lead to some healing and dialogue. I do think that having this designation of the National Register is one step toward claiming our authority on being that place, she says. We have our Texas landmark, but for every one of these designations we get, it is like someone saying, that is really important to our understanding of American history, and hopefully people are more comfortable talking about it. For Marfa Recycling, Problems and Cardboard Are Piling Up, by Abby Perot, ABBIE at BigBenSentinel.com. Marfa. As the international recycling market has slowed, Marfa's recycling sales have ground to a near halt. Companies who previously purchased and transported Marfa's recycling out of the area are no longer buying. With the city placing cardboard recycling dumpsters on hiatus, illegal dumping has risen in its place. At the get-go, Code Enforcement Officer Christina Pryor describes what has rapidly become an illegal dumping situation. Tires have been illicitly deposited in the remaining dumpster, and cardboard has repeatedly been left on the ground where the recycling dumpster once stood. Pryor was initially concerned that citizens were not using their properly assigned dumpster and warned against it on social media. In speaking with utility clerk Lori Flores and city manager John Washburn, Pryor later learned dumpsters are not assigned. Irma Salgado is a city council member and employee at the get-go. We need to settle this recycling issue once and for all. Whether we're picking it up or people are taking it over there, it's got to be taken care of, she said. Pryor hasn't heard illegal dumping complaints from other former cardboard recycling dumpster sites, like Stripes and Porter's, though Stripes has some dumpsters that lock and can only be accessed by the business. Beyond Marfa residents who pay for dumpster use and can deposit their trash in Republic Services dumpsters around town, there is an issue of ranchers and others from outside the area utilizing trash services without paying for them. Pryor says county residents and people outside city limits take advantage of Marfa dumpsters. I don't think we need to be the dumpster police, Marfa City Attorney Teresa Todd warned when the subject came up at a December 10th City Council meeting. Monitoring dumpsters at all hours can be tricky, and it is difficult to catch and verify that someone is using a dumpster illegally. However, when there is trash being placed next to and not inside of dumpsters, or bulky waste left by dumpsters or anywhere that is not an approved solid waste site, or waste that is being disposed of for commercial purposes, then that is where we get into illegal dumping, which is a violation of the Texas Health and Safety Code 365.012 and a misdemeanor offense, Pryor said. Salgado wants to raise awareness about illegal dumping and hopes to improve the issue outside the get-go. The city installed a sign where the cardboard recycling dumpsters used to be and added a camera to see how the area is being used. Residents can report dumping issues if they see something, Pryor said, but it's kind of futile because I cannot really act on it unless they bring proof, like photos or videos, or if the trash has identifiable features. Washburn said at the city meeting he was aware of the issue and is trying to figure out what's an appropriate solution that actually has some teeth, but also will endure. Hello, this is Kay reading the Big Bend Sentinel for December 19th, 2019. Obituaries. Dominguez. Joe Richard Dominguez, 94, a native of Fort Davis, Texas, passed away in El Paso, Texas, on December 9, 2019, after a short illness. Joe was born on June 6, 1925, the ninth offspring of Alejandro and Francisca McIntyre Dominguez, and was the grandson of Felipe and Manuela Dominguez, pioneers and early ranchers of Fort Davis. He was preceded in death by his parents, his first wife, Tilly Dominguez, second wife, Gloria Marin Dominguez, and all of his older siblings, Felice Sr., Benjamin, Ezequiel, Elias, Dolores, Victorina Alvarado, Sam, Alejandro Jr., Alex, and Irene Dominguez. He is survived by his daughter, Yolanda Ramirez, three grandchildren and eight great-grandchildren, as well as numerous nieces and nephews. Alpine Memorial Funeral Home has been entrusted with his services. A military graveside service will be held on Thursday, December 19th, at 2 p.m. at St. Joseph's Catholic Cemetery in Fort Davis, Texas, with the Reverend Gregory Meads conducting the service, with a luncheon to follow. All are invited to join the family. Online condolences may be left at www.alpinememorialfuneralhome.com. Gerke. Margaret C. Trott Gerke, spelled G-O-E-R-K-E, 80, a longtime resident of Fort Davis, Texas, passed away peacefully at her home on December 16, 2019, after a long illness. Margaret was born to Emil and Margaret Kerr Trott in 1939 in Iowa City, Iowa. Margaret is survived by her son, John Chris Kluseman Rutherford, and two grandchildren. Also her sister, Carolyn McDonald of Kansas City, Missouri, brother Emil Mari Trott of Sterling, Colorado, and many nieces and nephews. Margaret has donated her body for research to the School of Medicine at Texas Tech University in El Paso, Texas. A memorial service will be held in Fort Davis at a yet-to-be-determined date. Gifts may be made to the Fort Davis Methodist Church, Post Office Box 1439, Fort Davis, Texas, 79734. Alpine Memorial Funeral has been entrusted with arrangements. Online condolences may be left at www.alpinememorialfuneralhome.com. Jurado. Esteban S. Steve Jurado, spelled J-U-R-A-D-O, was called to the Lord on December 14, 2019, at the age of 92. He was born December 26, 1926, in Ruidosa, Texas. He is survived by daughters Delia Martinez of Marfa, Texas, Virgie Payares and husband Eddie of Marfa, Texas, Rachel and husband Johnny of El Paso, Texas, and Irma Espinosa and husband Alfredo of Odessa, Texas. Sons are Javier and wife Terry of Alpine, Texas, David and Vanessa of Marfa, Texas, one sister, Juanita Duran of Torrance, California, and his birthday buddy, Albert Dominguez of Marfa, Texas. He was blessed with 16 grandchildren and 22 great-grandchildren. Esteban was preceded in death by his son, Danny Jurado, grandson, Davis Justin Jurado, great-granddaughter, Monique Justin Jurado, parents, Tomas and Antonio Jurado, and brothers, Crescencio, Antonio, and Nicholas. A celebration of life will be held on Friday, December 20th, 2019, at 1 p.m., at St. Mary's Catholic Church, 211 West San Antonio, Marfa, Texas, with a burial to follow at Merced Cemetery. remembrances and condolences may be shared with the family at www.heritagefuneralhomeofthebigbend.com. Hello, this is Kay reading the Fort Stockton Pioneer for Tuesday, December 31st, 2019. Front page, theater nears completion, workshop January 3rd and 4th. The remodeling and expansion of the Nelson Street Theater is in the final stretch, with the Fort Stockton Community Theater's performance of the musical melodrama Ragweed Cowboy Joe tentatively set for March. The $2 million project has been funded through private donations and grants. Last week, received another $250,000 from the Fort Stockton Economical Development Corporation. Photos taken December 24th show the new stage and seating area taking shape. Flooring and finishing work, as well as other tasks, remain ahead of the opening. On Friday and Saturday, January 3rd and 4th, the theater will host a stagecraft workshop backstage at Theater, 102 South Nelson Street. The workshop will be led by Brian Serrano and a crew from the Permian Playhouse in Odessa, starting at 10 a.m. on both days. During the workshop, participants will build 12 flats and 5 platforms that can be used to create sets for productions in the new theater. The workshop will break for lunch and dinner and finish at 9:30 p.m. Volunteers can work all or any part of the available hours, according to Alice Dirksen. She may be reached at 432-336-3180 for more information. Anyone of any age who can wield a saw, a screwdriver, or a paintbrush is invited to participate. Students can receive Texas Scholar Hours for their help. People who are interested in acting, singing, dancing, or helping backstage for the March performance of Ragweed Cowboy Joe, a musical melodrama by I.E. Clark, should stop by the theater between 10 a.m. and 5:30 p.m. on either January 3rd or 4th to sign up. Three tenors perform January 21st. The Tenors Unlimited from Great Britain, also known as the Three Tenors, will perform a concert fundraiser for the Fort Stockton Community Theater on Tuesday, January 21st at Northside Church. The concert, sponsored by the Pecos County State Bank and First National Bank, is themed That's Amore and will include performances by the choirs from Fort Stockton Middle and High Schools. Tickets are available at Fort Stockton Chamber of Commerce, $25 for adults, $20 for senior citizens 65 plus, and $10 for students. Hello, this is Kay reading the Fort Stockton Pioneer for Tuesday, December 31st, 2019. Obituary. Rosalba Herrera Nunez. Rosalba Herrera Nunez passed away on Saturday, December 21st, 2019, at the age of 54. She was born November 5th, 1965, in Fort Stockton, Texas, to her parents, Mauricio Herrera and Margarita Gonzalez. Rosalba was preceded in death by her father and her sister, Ernestina Herrera. She is survived by her mother, her husband, Armando Garcia, her son, Ramon David Nunez of Odessa, Texas, daughters Jessica Lynn Nunez and Hector of Austin, Texas, and Cassandra Cherry and husband Christopher of Leander, Texas, brothers Roy Herrera, Refugio Olivas, and Cruz Herrera, sisters Sandra Benavente, Margie Gomez, Nelly Ramirez, and Minerva Herrera, and her 6 grandchildren. A funeral service was held on Friday, December 27th, 2019, at 2 p.m. at Heritage Funeral Home. Remembrances and condolences may be shared with the family at www.heritagefuneralhomeofthebigbend.com. Hello, this is Kay reading the Monahan's News for Thursday, December 26th, 2019. Front page. Former MPD officer pleads guilty to federal child porn charges. Sentencing to be held in March. By Christy Sullivan, staff writer. Former Monahan's police officer, Marshall Lacey Hobbs, 35, of Andrews, was arrested on November 26th after he admitted to receiving pornographic images and videos from a 17-year-old Andrews High student with whom he was having a sexual relationship. The arrest came after a 2-week investigation by Texas Rangers and Andrews Police Department. Texas Rangers seized a cell phone belonging to Hobbs and executed a search warrant for that device, along with other devices and apps, according to the federal complaint. The complaint states Hobbs had a sexual relationship with an AHS student for months and received pornographic images and videos from her. Hobbs began working for the MPD on February 15, 2019, after an honorable discharge from Kermit Police Department. We hired Hobbs in February. He applied here looking to switch agencies, MPD Captain Christopher Quintana said. MPD Chief Billy Riley said, I was notified of the investigation by the Texas Rangers, and on November 13th, I called Hobbs into the office and asked him if this investigation would cause him to lose his peace officer license. Hobbs stated that it would, and I terminated his employment at that time. Riley added, during his employment with MPD, there was never an indication of anything inappropriate was going on with any minors in Monahan's. If there had been, he would have been terminated immediately. Before coming to Monahan's, Hobbs worked for Kermit Police Department as well as La Mesa Police Department. In a phone call to Lieutenant Richard Abalos of the Kermit PD, Abalos stated, Hobbs worked here for around 4 years and in his time here, had no infractions, and no one has come forward since the news broke with any allegations regarding Hobbs. A phone call to the La Mesa Police Department was not returned as of press time. It is certainly a tremendous disappointment for our community to learn of the arrest of Marshall Hobbs by Texas Rangers for sexual misconduct with an Andrews High School student. Prior to his arrest, Marshall Hobbs was dismissed from the Monahan's Police Department when he informed Chief Billy Riley that he would lose his law enforcement license, City Manager Rex Tay said. Marshall performed his duties as a police officer fine while employed with the Monahan's Police Department, but unfortunately made some very serious mistakes in his personal life, he added. In September of 2003, Hobbs was arrested on a charge of theft, more than $50, less than $500, a Class C misdemeanor in Andrews County. We did a full background check on Hobbs and nothing came up on his report. Class C misdemeanors do not show up after 10 years, Riley said. On Monday, December 16th, Hobbs entered a guilty plea during a United States District Court hearing in Midland, and sentencing is scheduled for March 11th, 2020, in Midland, before U.S. District Judge David Counts. The felony offense carries a sentence ranging between 5 and 20 years in prison and a maximum $250,000 fine. Hobbs is currently out of custody on a $20,000 bond, pending sentencing, according to court records. According to the affidavit, the investigation began November 12th when Rangers were requested to assist Andrews PD after the victim made a statement to a school counselor regarding a police officer with whom she was having a sexual relationship. Officers later contacted the victim's mother at her residence in Andrews. The victim's mother said she learned of her daughter's relationship with Hobbs around 3 weeks earlier and that she told her she didn't want her communicating with him, according to the complaint. The victim's mother then told us that she had found her daughter with a phone she is not allowed to have due to prior incidents, but she purchased it through a friend at work and took it from her, officers stated in the complaint. The mother then voluntarily gave us the phone. During an interview with officers, the victim confirmed she had been engaged in a sexual relationship with Hobbs for months, and that during the relationship, she had, on several occasions, transmitted nude photographs and sexually explicit videos of herself to Hobbs via internet apps. The victim also told officers that Hobbs responded to the images and never told her to stop sending them. Additionally, she said Hobbs told her to delete their conversations and all the images and videos. Soon after the interview, rangers seized Hobbs' phone. The ranger who seized the phone also told other investigators he had briefly spoken with Hobbs, and when asked about the victim, Hobbs told him that he didn't know she was 17 and that we would find stuff on his phone, according to the complaint. On November 13th, investigators obtained a search warrant for the victim's phone and found numerous images and videos of the victim in the nude and in sexually explicit videos. Also that day, officers retrieved an older iPhone from the victim's mother that was taken from the victim last year, the document states. The mother gave her consent as the owner of the phone to search and seize any evidence pertaining to this investigation, officers said in the complaint. Both phones were released to the DPS's Criminal Investigations Division to be downloaded for the investigation. Hobbs met with investigators in Andrews on November 18th, the affidavit states. Hobbs confessed that he did engage in a sexual relationship with the victim earlier in the year and that he never asked her how old she was until after the first time they had sexual relations, officers state in the document. Hobbs said the victim told him she was 17. Hobbs also confessed to receiving nude and sexually explicit photographs and videos from the victim on several occasions over the past month or so. Hobbs said at the time he was receiving the photographs and videos, he knew the victim was only 17 years of age and that it was illegal for him to be in possession of the material, investigators added in the complaint. Hobbs said upon receiving the illegal material, he would open the attachments, look at them, and on occasion respond to them with comments such as, "Nice." Hobbs said he would then delete them from his device and tell the victim to delete their message thread. Hobbs said he knew he was wrong and he was an idiot for doing it. On November 21st, investigators obtained a search warrant for records pertaining to a text app the victim used, according to the affidavit. Investigators conducted a search of the records, which included messages between the two, along with media files that included photographs and video files sent from the victim to Hobbs, it adds. While searching the records, I observed messages between the victim and Hobbs beginning on October 18th, 2019, in which the victim first contacts Hobbs from the app, investigators stated in the affidavit. Hobbs asks, "Who is this? I have a message from this number, but I don't recognize it," to which the victim then identifies herself to him. Several days later, Hobbs messaged the victim, "So if you have had this phone for a while, why have you not sent those messages we talked about before? You know," the affidavit states. The victim then sent Hobbs a sexually explicit video of herself, it adds. More photos and video images were sent by the victim between October 22nd and November 11th, along with message exchanges. Based on the information contained in this affidavit, there is probable cause to believe Hobbs did knowingly and willingly receive child pornography, the document states. Gonzalez booked after stealing packages from residents, by Christy Sullivan, staff writer. Casey Jeanette Gonzalez, 40, of 805 East 2nd Street, was arrested on December 19th on a Ward County warrant for theft from person, mail theft, a Class A misdemeanor. According to Lieutenant Frarin Valle, Ward County Sheriff's deputies were dispatched to the 2400 block of West 15th Street after they received a call at approximately 6:24 p.m. regarding theft of a FedEx package. Through the course of the investigation, a suspect vehicle was identified. A deputy recognized the suspect vehicle and conducted an investigative stop at the Kentquick parking lot and identified the operator as Gonzalez, Valle said. The deputy saw the FedEx packaging in plain view, which matched the property that had been identified as stolen. Gonzalez was detained and questioned at the sheriff's department. A warrant was obtained for her arrest on the charge of mail theft, and she was booked into Ward County Jail on Thursday night. Bond was set at $5,000, and Gonzalez remains in jail in lieu of posting the bond. Carrasco Ortiz booked on charges of manufacturing / delivery. By Christy Sullivan, staff writer. Richard Damian Carrasco Ortiz, 22, of Monahans, was booked into the Ward County Jail on December 9th on charges of possession of marijuana less than 2 ounces, a Class B misdemeanor, manufacturing delivery of a controlled substance, penalty group 1, greater than 4 grams, less than 200 grams, and burglary of a vehicle. According to Monahans Police Department Captain Christopher Quintana, Officer Guzman responded to a call of a disturbance in the 700 block of South Alice Street. Upon arrival, Guzman observed Ortiz trying to fight with a black female, Quintana added. Ortiz was detained, and officers learned Ortiz broke into a vehicle at 715 South Main. Ortiz was seen breaking into the vehicle by the owner, and that's who he was apparently fighting around the corner when Officer Guzman arrived on the scene, Quintana said. Ortiz was also found to be in possession of marijuana, as well as in the possession of narcotics packaged up to sale, he added. Ortiz was subsequently arrested and booked on charges of possession of marijuana, manufacturing delivery of a controlled substance, and burglary of a vehicle. Bond was set at $30,000 for the manufacturing charge and $5,000 each for the possession and burglary charges. Ortiz remains in jail in lieu of posting the $40,000 bond. The case is still under investigation, and it's not clear if Ortiz will face more charges. King indicted for assault, family violence. By Christy Sullivan, staff writer. Jesse Xavier King, 32, of Alabama, was arrested and booked into Ward County Jail on December 12th on a Ward County warrant grand jury indictment for assault family violence of family member, impeding breath or circulation, a third-degree felony. The grand jury for the 143rd Judicial Court returned the indictment on September 26th. The indictment states that on or about April 23rd, King did knowingly and recklessly cause bodily injury to Angel Nicole Price, a person with whom the defendant had or had a dating relationship with, by intentionally and recklessly impeding the normal breathing or circulation of the blood of Price by applying pressure to her throat and neck. If convicted, King could face 2 to 10 years in prison and or a fine up to $10,000. Bond was set at $25,000. King posted the bond on December 12th and was released. As a condition of the bond, king shall not go within 1,000 feet of Price or any other complainant alleging assault, family violence, household member with previous conviction, shall not have any contact with her, her siblings, by writing, telephone, or any other means, nor send messages to any siblings, and shall not go within 1,000 feet of her residence. Desert Ridge Edition plans approved by MEDC, by Christy Sullivan, staff writer. Monahan's Economic Development Corporation board members approved the final plans for the Desert Ridge Edition in the East Monahan's subdivision. Ron Chestnut with LOA Investments was on hand for the meeting and presented the board with the final plans, which were recently approved by the city. The plan includes 344 lots for single-family homes, 90 standard lots for 180-unit multifamily duplex, and 24 corner cul-de-sac lots for an additional 48 units. It also includes 105-unit townhomes, two apartment complexes, the new elementary school, 8 commercial lots, a mobile home park with 100 lots, and the possibility of an additional mobile home lot or temporary RV lot for construction workers. All the development rides on us getting the Monahan's Parkway built. Once that happens, plans will be able to move forward, she said. A timeline on when the construction to pave Monahan's Parkway Street from 12th Street to Business 20 is still unknown. Board members agreed to a bid of $2.4 million to construct the 3,859-feet-long road. In other business, members tabled a buyback option of a 3.5-acre section of Block 27 to MKM Ventures, LLC, pending a contract from the attorneys. In January, directors approved the sale of the land to MKM Ventures, LLC, with the intent to build a Staybridge Suites Hotel. The agreed sale price of the property is $350,000. The contract stipulates that on or before October 31st, buyer is to pour a concrete slab for a minimum three-story, 90-room flag hotel, and the structure to be completed on or before October 31st, 2021, to which they have not met the deadline, citing investment issues, MEDC Director Ashley Adalto said. The property sold to MKM Ventures is the majority of Block 27, with the exception of a section noted as 200 feet by 260 feet on the front east side of Block 27, which was sold to Ever and Marielena Sainz at a price of $40,000 for a new coffee shop. Construction for the coffee shop is well underway, Adalto noted. In regular business, the directors approved accounts payable for the month of November, totaling $169,976.70, which included $160,000 to Security Preferred Title for the 8th and Main Street property closing, $7,258.13 for payroll salaries, and $200 to Swanner Photography for website photos. The financial report reflecting a balance of $3.2 million in available funds and minutes of the November 18th meeting were approved. Directors present were Larry Bryant, Richard Irwin, and Camilla Blum. Oscar Fuentes and Brian Franks were absent.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahan's News for Thursday, January 2nd. Community embraces new county extension agent. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. The Ward County community has warmly embraced the county's newest extension agent, Haley Lacaz. She joined the staff at the Ward County Extension Office in February as an assistant to Abigail Pritchard as part of the Family and Community Health Services. She became the leader of that post when Pritchard accepted an AgriLife position in Midland over the summer. Quote, "The 4-H family and the entire community have welcomed me with open arms. This is a great community," she said. Haley grew up in Natchitoches, Louisiana, and is a self-proclaimed country girl. She grew up raising and selling livestock with her family, especially Brangus cattle, and more recently several varieties of goats, including pygmy goats. She graduated from Northwestern State University of Natchitoches in 2018 with a Bachelor of Science degree, majoring in general studies and a minor in social science. When she was offered the position in Monahans, her boss told her, quote, "You should make a trip to Monahans before you give me your final answer," end quote. Quote, "I was working at Bell's at the time, and I didn't understand why at first, but I told my mom, we're going to Monahans for a trip," Haley said. "I came out during the stock show last January. It was just like home, just different scenery," end quote. Haley has been involved in 4-H her entire life. In high school, she was a junior leader for camps and helping with other parishes. In college, she was an adult volunteer and worked at camps across the state. Her role as a family and community health agent covers a large segment of community needs. It is a role that helps residents better their lives through science-based educational programs designed to improve the overall health and wellness of not only individuals, but families and communities as well. Nutrition and consumer education are also important aspects of her job. She has already conducted workshops dealing with child development and even ATV safety. Perhaps one of the more interesting experiences so far was a Stitch in Time workshop. Quote, "I couldn't even sew a button," she said with a laugh. "I told the kids we would learn together. It was a fun experience," end quote. One of the most successful programs to date was the Beautiful Workshop. A total of 42 preteen girls attended the day-long event with several local and area experts talking to the girls on topics such as beauty, preteen health, nutrition, finances, and more. Another important program, especially when people tend to overindulge with eating over the holidays, is a Maintain the No Gain program. Haley also has plans to bring back the Texas Extension Association, which would target topics for the entire community, such as food preparation and food safety, home safety, and winter gardening. Quote, "Lots of crafts and helping home educators are also things I want to do," she said. Asked what the most difficult part of her job was, she struggled trying to come up with an answer. Quote, "There is really nothing," she said pensively. On the other hand, asking her the favorite part of her job, she said without any hesitation, "The kids." Quote, "I do get a little homesick at times, but things are so busy, I don't have a lot of time to think about. But I do try to get home once in a while," Haley said. Haley's dad is a mechanic and specializes in logging equipment for the forestry industry. Her mother is a retired teacher, and one younger brother rounds out her Louisiana family.
That's all for today's Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa American, a production of the Recording Library of West Texas. You can also hear this program anytime online at recordinglibrary.org or by calling the telephone reader at 432-617-5555.